Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. My name is Fred Fleitz. I'm a senior vice president with the Center for Security Policy, and I am substituting for my boss, Frank Gaffney, the center's president, who is on a well-earned vacation. I have three excellent guests today, but I wanted to first do a short monologue on recent developments concerning North Korea. Now, I talked about North Korea yesterday, but something big happened, and that was after I did my show, there was a stunning Washington Post story that said that North Korea is now capable of miniaturizing nuclear warheads that could be fit into ballistic missiles, including ICBMs. Now, the media went wild on this story and said it indicated that we are moving into a whole new phase of the North Korean threat. This Washington Post story, which was co-authored by Joby Warwick, Ellen Nakashima, and Anna Fifield, also said that our intelligence community has concluded that North Korea may have as many as 60 nuclear weapons. Now, I explained yesterday that there were a variety of estimates on how many nuclear weapons North Korea has. Generally, most experts were saying 10 to 20, but there were some estimates by Chinese experts and by the Institute for Science and International Security of possibly 40 or 50 weapons. So this is within the realm of what other experts thought, maybe a little bit higher. There's something about this story that the mainstream media doesn't know. And I explained this on Fox and Friends this morning, and I wanted to mention it to you now. According to this Washington Post story, the Defense Intelligence Agency recently concluded that North Korea can make these miniaturized nuclear warheads that can fit in ballistic missiles, and that this is a major development. But in fact, Congressman Doug Lamborn accidentally disclosed this to a House Armed Services Committee hearing in 2013, and this was covered by the news media. But what's interesting here is that after Lamborn made this disclosure, the Obama administration went out of its way to hide it, to discredit it. The director of national intelligence said, well, that's just DIA's position. It is not the view of other intelligence agencies. And Obama officials went out of their way to ignore this or to belittle this conclusion by the Defense Intelligence Agency. So why did it do that? Well, the reason is the Obama administration was pursuing a strategy of strategic patience concerning North Korea. This was really a policy to do nothing and to kick this problem to the next president. So what is the Trump administration doing? It realizes that this is too serious a problem to ignore and to kick down the road. So what we saw yesterday was not a leak. It was an authorized disclosure of information. And the purpose of this was to advance the Trump administration's policy to address the threat from North Korea. If this was a leak, we would have heard White House officials complaining that this is a leak and there's going to be investigations. You know, it is appropriate to disclose information in certain circumstances to advance policy. This is using intelligence to advance our national security. It is done all the time. So when the Washington Post ran this, I don't think they realized that they actually were helping Mr. Trump advance his policy. Don't tell that to Jeff Bezos. He's not going to be pleased. And the purpose of this is to follow up on what happened last weekend when the toughest sanctions to date were imposed by the UN Security Council. But as I explained in my last monologue, there are problems with these sanctions because they will do nothing. They will not be effective unless China enforces them. And I think the disclosure yesterday of this information from the Defense Intelligence Agency and the very strong warning in response by President Trump has one purpose. It's to put pressure on China to, for once, start complying with Security Council sanctions that are intended to stop these extremely dangerous North Korean nuclear and missile programs. We have to have China make a decision that this is such a serious situation that it has to put the pressure on North Korea it has to date refused to put on to stop these programs. And there are many, many things that China could do. As you may know, there were sanctions implemented last November that put a cap on iron ore and coal exports from North Korea to China. Well, what happened? China ignored this cap, and North Korea's trade with China increased by 37% in the first quarter of 2017, and its iron ore exports increased by 250%. This is where North Korea is getting the funds it's using to make all these missiles, to conduct all these nuclear tests. These programs cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And North Korea is getting these dollars, this hard currency, from China because China has refused to abide by the sanctions resolutions that are intended to send a message to North Korea and hopefully change its behavior. Now, North Korea has predictably threatened the United States in response to these new sanctions. It's threatened to attack Guam. Look, that's not going to happen. We know that North Korea is developing more advanced ballistic missiles, but they are notoriously inaccurate. And I think it's very unlikely that North Korea could hit Guam. And if North Korea fired a missile in the direction of Guam, the U.S. would shoot it down, and the retaliation against North Korea would be quite severe. I don't think it's going to do that, but it is the type of bellicose threat that we've come to expect from North Korea whenever we take action. The key is, how will China follow up? Will China realize that we have a president in the White House who is not going to lead from behind? He's not going to bow to foreign leaders. He is not going to pursue a policy of strategic patience and try to kick this inconvenient problem down the road. President Trump and his advisors realize that the trajectory of North Korea's nuclear missile programs is so worrisome that we very well could have a war, possibly by miscalculation, if something is not done to stop it. Why would North Korea be developing ICBMs? One can understand, and I don't want to say I understand, but I mean, if North Korea wanted to argue we have nuclear weapons as a deterrent, that's one thing. But to build ICBMs that, in theory, and the missiles fired in July, in theory, could strike the east coast of the United States if they had their maximum estimated range. This is not a state that is looking to protect itself. This is a state that is preparing for offensive combat. I don't know what the purpose of this is. Will North Korea sometime try to use its nuclear missile arsenal to blackmail the world to absorb South Korea into North Korea? If North Korea develops H-bombs, and it's going to have H-bombs someday, I know some experts have said North Korea could have H-bombs within a couple of years. From the nuclear physicists I've talked to, they don't believe that, but they do believe that North Korea is trying to perfect this extremely complex technology. But someday North Korea is going to get there. H-bombs could be 100 times more powerful than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, you know, we're talking about a cataclysmic nuclear encounter that would have an effect on this planet and Asia that I don't think we want to think about. So what we saw yesterday, I think, was a very careful and very clever strategy to send a message not just to North Korea, not just to the American people, but a message to China that the President of the United States sees this as a very dire and growing problem, and a problem that he is simply not going to ignore. And I think there will be additional sanctions taken against North Korea outside of the UN, And if China does not comply, I think there will be sanctions against China. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. My name is Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney. Next up, syndicated columnist Diana West will discuss with me the growing controversies concerning National Security Advisor General H.R. McMaster. Stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. My name is Fred Flight, substituting for your usual host, Frank Gaffney, who is taking a well-deserved vacation. My first guest today is nationally syndicated columnist Diana West. She is author of The Death of the Grown-Up, An American Betrayal, and one of the smartest experts on international security that I know. Diana, welcome.
Oh, well, thank you, Fred. Wonderful to be with you.
You know, I can't think of anyone I'd like to talk to more to get a take on the problems we're seeing within the National Security Council concerning the director, General H.R. McMaster. There have been stories that former Obama officials are pressing him to let go conservatives. There's concern by quite a few conservatives in this town that General McMaster is not promoting the policies of the president and that Mr. McMaster should be let go. Give me your take on this and the state of play.
I would love to, and I'd like to start by saying that I would say the president is not promoting his own policies. It's all very well to blame General McMaster for what's going on, but ultimately this is a presidential decision. That said, remember a year ago when President Trump gave his first foreign policy address, and he actually specified that he wanted a very different kind of foreign policy, that he would look for talented experts with approaches and practical ideas rather than surrounding myself with those who have perfect resumes, but very little to brag about except responsibility for a long history of failed policies and continued losses at war. Now, we look at the continued losses of war. We look at Iraq, we look at Afghanistan, and certainly General McMaster is deeply involved with General Petraeus and the entire military establishment that created the strategies that ended up in those losses at war that President Trump essentially told us and ran on, stopping, halting, starting afresh. And so this is actually the root of the problem, is that President Trump seems to have forgotten his own agenda.
There's a fascinating story by Jed Babin on this issue concerning the leadership problems with the National Security Council that refers to General McMaster as the ultimate holdover. And apparently he made a statement that there are no holdovers in the NSC, meaning that there may be Obama holdovers, but he's not going to call them that. What's your take on this?
Well, this is, again, business as usual. This is the swamp asserting its prerogatives. In terms of swamp, meaning establishment, meaning the deep state is one way of looking at it, but just in terms of the bureaucratic continuity from one administration to the other, whether it's Bush to Obama and now to Trump. When H.R. McMaster first came into his slot, there was discussion of his points of view, and one of the things that I would have thought would have given him walking papers was his own aversion to the phrase, which for me is only partway there, but in terms of talking about radical Islamic terrorism, which became President Trump's catchphrase, talking about the threats of expansionist Islam would be my way of looking at it. McMaster wouldn't even go to that level of discussion, radical Islamic terrorism, because he thought it was unhelpful, because he thought terrorism was un-Islamic, quote, in the first place. This is an absolute return to the whole notion of appeasing Islam in order to try to win Islam over to our side, which was the basis of the counterinsurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan, which ended up in tremendous defeats for the United States. Again, we thought Trump was going in a different direction. So the question becomes, what does Trump know And when will he do something about it? That this is an enduring frustration with so many Trump supporters who actually believed that he was going to break with this terrible past policy. And we are not seeing that break, and we are seeing the entrenchment of this same policy of appeasement inside his own White House. And now, as you reference, the holdovers, the purging of the pro-Trump officials in the NSC and elsewhere. So this is a terrible, terrible conundrum. And again, one wonders, what does President Trump think about these things? What's going on? I mean, this is something I hear all the time from people.
Well, I might add, concerning the term radical Islamic terrorism, that was actually originally excluded from the president's Saudi speech, supposedly because of the influence of General McMaster, but the president either overruled him or just added it to the speech anyway. I want to ask a related question, and this is response to a brilliant article by Admiral Ace Lyons in the Washington Times on August 6th, titled "Resetting the Foreign Policy Agenda," in which he argues that there really has to be a substantial house cleaning within the National Security Council, the State Department, the Department of Defense. How would you recommend the president getting a hold of his foreign policy and carrying out what he had promised to do during the campaign?
Well, the first thing you should do is call up Admiral Lyons and have lunch and get his extremely wise counsel and experienced counsel. And he should all, I mean, you know, I feel that President Trump excluded all of the supporters and very experienced and respected supporters of his desire to break with the past. And that would include the folks at your shop, the Center for Security Policy, Frank Gavney and yourself, and many others who have supported him all throughout. This is the notion of he came to town and he didn't bring any of his posse. And if we go back to the campaign trail and we see your Sarah Palins and your Rudy Giuliani's, his complete break, it seems, with Sheriff Arpaio, for example, another one of his stalwarts on the campaign trail, is one of the great disgraces, I think, of his administration to date. I hope he corrects it, you know, in terms of Sheriff Arpaio's conviction recently, and no presidential pardon, no word. It's just an amazing thing. It's as if you go back to the Carter administration, another outsider in the Washington scene, he came to town with what we used to call the Georgia Mafia. I mean, this is the thing. Reagan came in with his kitchen cabinet, the people from California. Trump did not come into town with his people. And I think that this is the fundamental flaw of this administration. It is not leaks. It is because personnel in place want to destroy him, and they leak. The problem of leaks would go away without any kind of justice investigation if President Trump simply hired people who supported his agenda. And I think this is the basic problem of Trump, and this is what people do not understand about Trump. Does he just not get it? Is he part of it? What's going on? I mean, this is sort of a giant question mark that just is over his entire administration at this point of crisis.
Well, I see this as an insurgency presidency, and I've actually argued with liberals on the air that Trump is an example why we can't have outsiders running government. I absolutely reject that. I think it's the insiders, it's the swamp that have caused us so many problems. But I'm with you. I know so many people in town who are good conservatives who seem to be on a no-call list when it comes to jobs with this administration. I mean, they've applied for jobs and they can't even get an interview. They don't get phone calls. And I just have to think, who's in charge of personnel? Why is this happening?
Well, that's exactly a very good question. You go to the personnel, people who are in charge of personnel, and you find the swamp. You find the same establishment acting as gatekeepers on the administration. And this is a fundamental problem. It afflicts many conservative administrations over time, but in this case, it seems to be the very worst yet. And I wonder, who does even President Trump speak to at this point, outside of a couple of names I could come up with? But even people who are not versed on all of these questions, you know, he really has very little in terms of counsel that I would consider dependable. And again, part of his own agenda, people who seized up and had been working for these same kinds of issues for many years with great experience, who are not, don't seem to be, as you say, on his call list. And this is a tremendous tragedy. And one wonders, how insulated is he? He's got a chief of staff now. He's got General McMaster? I mean, are these people helping him get a wide range of opinion, or are they shutting him down? And I'm afraid, to date, what we see is he's being shut down.
Well, Diana West, I'm afraid we have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for your analysis. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to continue this discussion in a few moments with my colleague at the Center for Security and Policy, Michael Waller. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. My name is Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney, who is taking a well-deserved vacation. My next guest is my friend and colleague, Mike Waller. He is Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the Center for Security Policy, editorial board member of the NATO Defense Strategic Communications Journal, and a senior writer at the American Media Institute. Mike, welcome.
Hi, Fred.
Well, Mike, I'd like to continue a discussion I just had with Diana West, and I'd like to sort of segue into talking about some of the significant things that the Center for Security Policy has issued this week concerning National Security Council Director H.R. McMaster. Now, our president, Frank Gaffney, put out a piece entitled President McMaster, and he put out a press release earlier this week that McMaster must go. Could you talk about this situation and where it stands right now?
Sure. It's a situation that would really shock people who elected Donald Trump to make America great again, because while that might be happening bit by bit here at home, it's not going to happen to make America great again on the world scale with McMaster running our national security strategy.
So please tell me some of the particulars on if we were to make a case on why the president should replace General McMaster. What would be the top issues you would raise?
Well, the first one is he's a globalist. He believes in a sort of he's very much part of the establishment. He's very much part of the liberal foreign policy and national security establishment. And that establishment views American people as citizens of the world and not citizens of the United States. So the whole idea of making America great again really nauseates these types of people. And they have this weird thing in their minds that there's nobody who knows anything about defense and foreign policy and national security who thinks in the make America great again way. And so the only people out there to protect global interests are those who never bought on to the make America great again idea. So McMaster's been purging people who supported President Trump during the campaign, you know, who subscribed to this Make America Great Again concept. And he's been retaining and even bringing back elements of not just the traditional establishment, but the elements from the Obama administration.
Well, Diana West and I were talking about that and how many conservatives around town who we know seem to be on a do not call list. From the White House to the State Department and the Defense Department, which is really pretty appalling. I want to turn to policy differences. The issue that I've been harping on concerns the nuclear deal with Iran, which General McMaster seems determined to push, despite clear evidence that Iran is violating this agreement and that it is not in the national interest of the United States, and opposition from several key Republican members of the U.S. Senate. Could you talk about some of the policy issues that worry you here?
Well, the first one on the Iran deal is that they're so legalistic, these establishment folks that McMaster personifies, they're so legalistic in the way they look at these, quote, deals, that they don't really, it doesn't really bother them what's happening as long as the technicalities on obeying those deals are obeyed, and the reality, is quite a different matter. So it's almost as if it's okay if Iran builds a nuclear missile program, as long as it doesn't violate the letter of the agreement according to the interpretation that they choose to make about that agreement. It's bizarre. It's kind of like a criminal defense lawyer twisting every subtlety of the law to get his murderer client off the hook.
Well, how about radical Islam and differences we've been hearing about that? Diana West and I were talking about that, and that seems to be an issue that has caused a lot of tension within the NSC.
Yes. Yes. And this is key. This ties into the Iran deal and to a lot of other things, too, because on the one hand, you have this bureaucratic establishment approach of violating or abiding by the letters of agreements and how you interpret that. And this includes the jihadist Shiite regime in Iran. But then there's a very different issue, which is the see no evil approach to anything Islamic and jihadist, and even equating the fact that jihad is a fundamental tenet of Islam, and therefore that's something you have to deal with, not just with the Iran regime, because its nuclear weapons program is its grand jihad. But he also, McMaster also doesn't want to see any connection between Islam and terrorism and, quote, violent extremism, or even worse, the subversive extremism of, say, the Muslim Brotherhood and others. There he takes a see no evil approach, and he seems to be protecting regimes like Qatar in the Persian Gulf, which is the number one state sponsor of Islamic subversion and violence, and Saudi Arabia, for that matter, which is a rival regime to that of Qatar. But he seems to take a benign view toward them and toward others who are promoting, supporting, training, and funding our enemies.
Now, over the last couple of weeks, there's been some controversy over conservatives who H.R. McMaster appeared to sack from the National Security Council, some of whom were brought in by his predecessor, General Flynn. Could you talk about these people, and why has the number of these firings accelerated recently?
Part of it is because the NSC is so bloated in size, staff is so bloated in size, that it takes a long time to fire people and replace them with somebody. So that's one issue. I think another one is some of them were relatively new hires, like Rich Higgins. He was a relatively new hire. And when he wrote something that the president actually liked, and the president praised him for it, according to the reports I saw, and McMaster disliked it, then he used insubordination or disloyalty or whatever excuse he used to get rid of this person. And this was someone the president actually who supported the president during the campaign, unlike McMaster, and who supports his MAGA vision now. So let's look at just a few of the names. Jed Babin wrote a great piece in the American Spectator recently called McMaster, the Ultimate Holdover. He says that dozens, in fact, as many as 50 Obama holdovers are still on the National Security Council staff, and that McMaster has kept them there. But he listed four very specific senior people who reported directly to Obama's own national security propaganda chief, Ben Rhodes. The first one is McMaster's own special assistant, his personal special assistant, Abigail Grace, Obama holdover. The National Security Council Director for South America, Fernando Kutz, Obama holdover. Andrew Hall, who's the NSC Senior Director for Countering Weapons of Mass Destruction, Terrorism, and Threat Reduction. Okay, this is where you get the whole Iran deal here. Andrew Hall, he's an Obama holdover. And Mary Lind, who's the NSC Director for Global and Asia Economics, she's an Obama holdover. These were four key Obama holdovers among dozens still on McMaster's staff who reported directly to Ben Rhodes, who created this whole narrative of Iran and of Iran's weapons of mass destruction and of who our real enemy really is.
Where do you think this is going? Do you think McMaster is going to be kept on by the president, or do you think he's going to survive this controversy?
Well, there are a few ways of looking at it, Fred. First of all, he wants his fourth star desperately. He's a three-star general. He's still active duty. He wants to retire with that fourth star. So he might cling on long enough to get that four-star in a year and then retire. He could also be thrown out. Once the president realizes the grassroots support of the president's own base is against putting this establishment liberal general in power to run our country's policy and be actually President McMaster, I think Donald Trump's going to finally remove him.
Well, Mike Waller, thank you so much for your analysis and for all the important work you do with the Center for Security Policy. I'm Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. Next up, Chris Farrell, Director of Investigations at Judicial Watch. Stay tuned.
to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. My name is Fred Flights. I'm substituting for Frank Gaffney, who is on a well-deserved vacation. My next guest will be Chris Farrell. He is Director of Investigations at Judicial Watch and host of the YouTube video series On Watch. Chris, welcome.
Great to be on with you, Fred. Thanks very much.
Chris, your organization does such important work investigating the Obama administration, and so many illegal and unethical doings that went on during that term. And there's something that you found recently concerning documents on a meeting between former President Clinton and the Attorney General Lynch, just as the investigation of Mrs. Clinton was progressing. And I see that one of your reports said that some of the documents released on this meeting had talking points blacked out. Could you talk about what you discovered?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So our audience already knows about the infamous meeting on the tarmac in Phoenix. But what is more interesting is the reaction in Washington to it. And so we've uncovered these emails through our FOIA litigation. We went to court and we compelled these agencies by legal process to provide these records to us. And when you read them, it's very clear that the Department of Justice and the FBI, their public affairs people and some headquarters staffers, were frantically trying to synchronize their stories. And so this event out on the tarmac in Phoenix became public due to a local reporter just happening really to stumble upon the meeting. And once word got out that there was this meeting, they referred to it as a red flag. So these public affairs guys at headquarters DOJ and headquarters FBI have this red flag event, and they are frantic to synchronize and coordinate their response using really happy talk language about how it was a chance meeting and it was brief and non-substantive and all this other nonsense. But it goes to show you the nerve that it struck, not just the Department of Justice and the FBI, but frankly, government-wide.
Well, I don't understand how, isn't the Trump Justice Department, they're releasing these documents, so why would they black out information concerning this meeting?
The reason, well, first, at face value, it's inexplicable, right? Why in the world would Trump and Sessions bend over backwards to protect and defend the Clintons and Lynch, right? It just doesn't make sense. But if you pause for a second and you realize you'll recall Sally Yates, the acting attorney general who defied the president's executive order travel restrictions. There's an army, an entire army of Sally Yates's operating under Attorney General Sessions. And so the deep state, or sort of the professional bureaucracy, is unchanged. And so ironically, we find the Trump-Sessions Justice Department making the same arguments, filing the same legal briefs, defending the same indefensible positions as the Obama Department. It's mind-boggling, but it's true.
So this sounds like the swamp is very active in the Justice Department. What do you know about how many key political appointees in the lower levels of the Justice Department, how many of them have been filled?
Yeah, virtually none. Certainly there have been some people, down to sort of the assistant or deputy attorney general level who have been nominated and gone through. In fact, there was a handful, at least, that went through just before the Senate went on recess. But in large part, the rank and file, sort of the heavy lifting folks, the journeyman level career staff, of attorneys and paralegals within that department are unchanged. If you were to do some demographic polling or testing of that population, they would all be, big Obama supporters, certainly.
I want to turn to another issue. This is a brewing scandal, although you wouldn't know it from the mainstream media, of three Pakistani-American brothers who were working, supporting computers of Debbie Wasserman Schultz and several other Democratic House members who apparently stole a significant amount of House equipment, may have broken into the emails of House members, some of the members of the House Intelligence Committee. I understand there is now a congressional investigation into this scandal that's moving forward, and I'm sure there's something that your organization is looking at, but I want to start with one question. Don't you think Debbie Wasserman Schultz should be brought before the House Ethics Committee on her efforts to not just her cooperation with the scandal, but apparently her efforts to conceal it?
Yeah, and we filed complaints concerning that. And frankly, the dishonest media, the alphabet soup, of broadcasters and the Post and Times, the rest of them, they should be camped out in front of her house or in front of her office. She needs to have a microphone stuck in her face and ask direct, hard questions about what in the world she was doing and why she kept the Awan brothers and, frankly, their gang. It totals up to about six or seven when you include spouses and a friend. These are people who wired hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Capitol Hill Credit Union to Pakistan, and in the case of the principal Awan's wife, she fled the country, unlawfully taking $12,400 with her, the limit's $10,000. And then Awan himself tried to flee the country, going to Pakistan. So, look, hundreds of thousands of dollars moved, outrageous billing of the Democratic Democratic staffers who use their IT services, access to the Intelligence and Foreign Relations Committee staffs, all their email, and this guy suddenly makes a run for it. This is more than bank fraud. This is more than, untoward behavior. This is a legitimate counter-espionage investigation that's got to be done vigorously.
Well, let me repeat something that's just extraordinary of this case. Imran Awan, one of the staffers who worked for Wasserman Schultz, he and his brothers and I believe his wife were all working in the IT staff, and they had their access to these computers suspended a few months ago when this scandal broke out. And he was recently arrested at Dulles Airport when he tried to flee the country, but we found out that Debbie Wasserman Schultz did not fire him until after he was arrested. And didn't that just happen last month?
Yeah, well, last week it happened. And this is, this is craziness. She kept him on. This whole story starts to break in early February by a fellow named Rosiak, who works at the Daily Caller. Luke Rosiak has been on top of the story he really broke it. And so the story starts to unwind in February. By, April, May, it's pretty outrageous just at face value. There are some suspensions and some filings. Wasserman Schultz keeps the ringleader, the principal guy, on her staff as a quote-unquote advisor right up until what you just mentioned. What kind of judgment, what kind of thought process is going on? It makes me wonder, Wasserman Schultz was yanked from being the DNC chief because of outrageous emails. What does this guy have on her?
Well, what indeed. I think this is really a major scandal. Chris Farrell, Director of Investigations at Judicial Watch, I'd like to thank you so much for all you do to promote the national security of our country, and I know that you're going to keep it up. I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in to Secure Freedom Radio. My name is Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney, and I hope you will tune in tomorrow.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.